This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Nick Money, professor of botany at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, and author of several books, including The Triumph of the Fungi, Carpet Monsters and Killer Spores, Mr. Bloomfield's Orchard, and Mushroom. Nick Money is here today to tell us about his most recent book, The Amoeba in the Room, Lives of the Microbes, published in 2014. Welcome, Nick.
A pleasure to talk with you, Diane.
What led you to write your book, Amoeba in the Room?
Well, I've spent a good part of the last decade writing books about fungi, and I tell my students that once upon a time I studied fungi for 30 years, which is actually true. It's terrifying, isn't it? But I actually began working on fungi in a professor's lab when I was 18 years old, and now I suppose as a part of a hopefully productive midlife crisis, I'm expanding my purview and I'm looking at organisms other than fungi. So this book actually was my first attempt to look at a much broader picture of biological diversity.
Why have we tended to focus on large animals and ignored microbes?
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? But I think that this is a product of our sensory systems. We're programmed to concentrate on the big things around us. I mean, organisms that are on the same spatial scale as ourselves, and this has a lot of logic to it. In evolutionary terms, we need to watch out for the big things that might eat us. We need to look out for things that we might eat. So for most of human history, we've ignored the microscopic majority of life on Earth.
Considering biological diversity, why is it a skewed approach to look mostly at plants and animals?
Because most of the biological information on the planet, most of the genetic information on the planet, is actually housed within microorganisms. It's housed within bacteria, it's housed within unicellular protists that have cells like our own, and even more diversity actually is found in viruses. So most of the stuff of life on this planet, although it isn't immediately apparent, is actually microscopic.
What technological advances have allowed us to learn more about microbes and their diversity?
The most important technological advance actually came in the 17th century with the invention of the microscope. But for a variety of reasons, this didn't, in the end, change much about the way that natural historians approached the study of nature, of biology. More recently, just in the last few decades, in the last 25 years, the introduction of molecular genetic methods has really revolutionized the study of microorganisms, and I think this has been very effective at showing us just how much we've been missing.
Would you give us an overview of the roles that microbes play in ecosystems?
Wow. I mean, microorganisms really drive energy flow through all ecosystems. If we look at seawater is interesting. A cup of seawater might contain 125 million cells and billions of viruses that prey on those cells. One of the things that those cells are doing in seawater is the same thing that green plants do on land. There's a single kind of bacterium, a cyanobacterium, that actually absorbs as much carbon dioxide as all of the world's rainforests. So this thing is absorbing 20 billion tons of carbon per year, accounting for maybe a fifth of all of the carbon fixation on the planet. And that's just a single kind of bacterium. So you've got a single bacterium, probably a stronger refrigerant than all of the world's tropical rainforests. There are organisms that actually bob alongside those bacteria called diatoms, and those diatoms probably, again, carry out an equivalent amount of photosynthesis. So you've got these two kinds of microorganisms in seawater that are producing maybe 50% of the oxygen that we breathe on Earth and are absorbing 50% of the carbon dioxide that's absorbed through photosynthetic activity. So this is one example of energy flow where these microorganisms are tremendously important for the health of the biosphere.
And what would happen if the organisms you just spoke about disappeared?
That's difficult to answer. I guess maybe we're in the early phases of that experiment, perhaps, by changing so much about the nature of the chemistry of seawater and the temperature of the biosphere. But certainly this would have profound consequences on planetary health. I think if we're taking away organisms that are carrying out so much photosynthetic activity, producing so much of the oxygen we breathe, this doesn't sound like a very sustainable future.
And what would likely happen to climate change?
Well, I think that that's one thing that the oceans are so, so important in actually absorbing heat, but also through the activities of these microorganisms, absorbing carbon dioxide. And so if one were to really damage the photosynthetic capacity of the oceans, the immediate effect of that would be to actually see a further increase in the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
Well, we've been focusing on marine ecosystems, but how do microbes contribute to soil fertility and plant health on land?
Soil actually teems with microorganisms. There are billions of bacteria and also other organisms called archaea within soil. And soil is also shot through with the filaments of fungi, the organisms that I used to concentrate on. And together, these organisms are extremely important in controlling soil fertility. We actually know surprisingly little, actually, about the microbial diversity in soil, but we do know that they're exceedingly important in breaking down organic material, that they're important for the flow of nitrogen through soils, and for all of the other major nutrient cycles. The microorganisms are just tremendously important.
Are there other ecosystems you would like to touch on?
Absolutely. There's one that we don't tend to think about too much is actually our air supply. Although, again, these microorganisms are invisible without a microscope, our air supply is filled with fungal spores and bacteria and viruses. It's been estimated fairly recently that maybe 50 million tons of fungal spores are ejected into the atmosphere every year, and that corresponds to an Avogadroian number of cells. This is a tremendous number of microscopic particles that are forced into the atmosphere every year. So this is affecting us in that virtually every breath that we take, we're inhaling the spores of fungi. And for those of us that suffer from asthma, this is a lifelong problem. Perhaps another even more interesting ecosystem that we might consider is the human body. I'm sure most of your listeners are aware that we carry trillions of bacteria in our guts, and the skin surface also teems with microbes. And it's not stretching the truth to say that we're really mobile ecosystems, that we carry these microorganisms on us and within us, and they control many, many aspects of our health and well-being. We are dependent upon those microorganisms, and they are dependent upon us.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Nick Money, professor of botany at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, and author of the book, The Amoeba in the Room, Lives of the Microbes. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Let's speak more about the microbes that colonize human bodies that you alluded to. To what extent do we harbor microbes? Could you say more?
So the estimates of the number of bacteria in the human gut vary from about 100 trillion cells to 1 quadrillion bacterial cells in the human gut, and that corresponds to about a liter of living cells within our digestive tract. And one of the important activities of the bacteria in the gut is to actually break down the complex carbohydrates in our diet. So these are carbohydrates in the form of materials in the vegetarian part of our diet and the plants that we eat. And actually the human genome lacks the instructions for breaking down a good number of these molecules. And so it's only actually when they get down into the gut, and particularly into the colon, that the bacteria can actually act on, work away on these molecules and actually supply us with calories in the form of little molecules called short-chain fatty acids. So that's one way in which we're completely dependent upon those bacteria, that we feed them, and then they also feed us. The organisms in the gut also interact 24/7 with our immune system, and we have very, very rich relationships with the bacteria in our guts, that they both support our health and in some cases they can harm us.
What are the factors that affect the organisms that live within our digestive tract, for example? To what extent does diet affect what's there?
So diet certainly has an effect upon the composition of this human microbiome. So we do see differences in the diversity of these organisms depending upon whether one is a vegetarian or has an omnivorous or a very meat-centered diet. So that's one thing, that diet certainly has a tremendous effect on this. Another obvious environmental influence is if we take antibiotics, that this can have devastating effects upon the diversity of organisms in the gut. And one thing that's interesting there is the genetic studies on the gut organisms suggest that these changes are actually quite long-term changes, that we can look at the gut of somebody that's been prescribed broad-spectrum antibiotics and their gut really hasn't returned to its former state, its normal state, even a couple of years after this dose of antibiotics. And of course, most of us as children were treated with antibiotics, and this again has profound effects upon the balance of microorganisms in the gut of children.
You've been focusing on the gut, but how about other parts of the human body? How similar are microbiomes in the different parts of the body?
They're actually very distinctive, and so if we look on the scalp, we can find a range of microorganisms that actually live on the scalp. Some of them feed on the sebum, the sebaceous secretions on the scalp, and these actually include lots of different kinds of yeasts that we find there that don't seem to be prevalent within the gut. And if you think about the surface of the human body, it presents many, many different challenges for microorganisms from those that are found in our digestive system. There's obviously a lot more oxygen availability, for example, whereas at the middle of the gut, there's little or no oxygen.
How similar are the microbiomes among different people?
A number of groups have actually studied this, and we see that there are certainly differences between the microbiomes of Americans, for example, or Northern Europeans compared with people in developing countries, particularly where they're eating a diet that is a lot more plant-based than the average American diet.
You mentioned the digestive contribution of microorganisms, but how do overall the microbes that live within us contribute to our well-being?
I'm not sure how to answer that, actually, just that without them, we would need to eat a lot more to make sure that we got sufficient calories to keep us going. These organisms then interact with our immune system. As I said, there may be a relationship between the gut microorganisms and whether or not we suffer from allergies. So many, many ways in which our interactions with microorganisms affect our health. There's also some studies that have been performed on mice that suggests that the activities of the microorganisms in the gut and the diversity of organisms in the gut may actually influence our behavior, or rather certainly affects the behavior of mice, and what goes for mice probably also goes for us. And some of the most interesting experiments have been performed on mice that are grown without a microbiome. These are called notobiotic mice, so they're raised and grown their whole lives without gut microorganisms. And so one thing is that they have to be fed a richer diet because they haven't got microbes in their guts to help them break down plant materials. And so they have this different diet to make up for the lost calories. But the other thing is that their behavior changes. And in some cases, they seem to be less anxious. They're more prone to actually explore their environment and not be scared of dark places within a maze, which is really remarkable. And there are changes in gene expression in the nervous system of these mice. And so it's not beyond the realm of possibilities that the microbiome actually really affects the way that we think, might affect the way that our nervous system is constructed, and affects our mood. It's an interesting thing. It necessitates some creativity here to sort of relate these findings from microbiological research to one's own life. But if you think about getting up in the morning and eating some toast, so full of these plant carbohydrates, you look out of the window and perhaps it's sunny, or maybe it's raining in Seattle, and you feel happy. But who's actually sending the signals? Is this the bacteria that are sending these signals? What am I? I'm a mobile ecosystem.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Nick Money, professor of botany at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, and author of the book, The Amoeba in the Room, Lives of the Microbes. A number of the microbes you speak about in your book are able to survive and thrive under very extreme conditions. What are some examples?
Yeah, the range of conditions that support microbial growth are really quite astonishing. Let's look at a number of different environmental variables. So if you look at sort of the hottest places, there's a particular microorganism. This is a kind of archaea. So it's like a bacterium in that this is an organism that lacks a nucleus. It's got a chromosome that's free within the center of the cell. But in any case, this particular microorganism can grow at 121 degrees Celsius, which is an important temperature because it's the temperature of an autoclave, the temperature that is used in research labs and in hospitals to sterilize surgical tools, which is absolutely remarkable. And I think the paper that described this organism originally said that this was chilled at 90 degrees. It quit dividing. 90 degrees C was just too cold for it. There's another microbe that divides once a month, so very slowly at the bottom of an Antarctic lake. The temperature there, 1 or 2 degrees Celsius at best. There's an organism, again, it's one of these archaea. It lives in very acidic conditions. So actually pH 0.06, this thing will grow and divide, and that's as acidic as battery acid. The list goes on. There's a radioactive or a radiophilic, I suppose, or radio-tolerant bacterium that survives a dose of 15,000 grays of ionizing radiation, and we perish at about 5 grays of exposure, which is really quite mind-boggling.
Could you go into more detail about how that microbe is actually able to survive and thrive in the radioactive environment?
It's a very interesting thing. It's a bacterium called Deinococcus or Deinococcus. One of its adaptations is that it has multiple copies of its genetic material. And the idea there is that, because presumably the radiation damage to its genome is going to be pretty profound as it's getting irradiated, but by having 4 copies of every gene, it's got something that it can use for proofreading. It's got a template that it can go back to and presumably find a valid copy of the gene. So, and it's got these astonishingly efficient repair mechanisms so that it can actually just keep dealing with the consequences of radiation damage.
Where have these organisms been found on planet Earth?
So that organism, along with the number of fungi, has been found, been quite a lot of work on it and other radio-tolerant organisms at the Chernobyl site in Ukraine. So that's one place that these organisms have been studied. But other than dealing with radioactive conditions, a lot of these microorganisms that we call extremophiles, they grow in our homes. You can find them in our bathrooms, for example. So if you think of a shower faucet that's, you know, alternately heated to quite a high temperature each morning, perhaps, and then cools them, there are microorganisms that grow particularly in that location. They can cope with that sudden heating and then swift cooling also. Our laundry rooms, where we're using laundry detergent that creates very alkaline conditions, there are microorganisms that grow there that we might otherwise find in Yellowstone National Park, perhaps, or relatives of these things. The dishwasher teems with different microorganisms, including some pathogens, some disease-causing microorganisms that seem to find a home within the dishwasher.
You spoke earlier about the interaction between microbes and the human body. Would you speak about the symbiosis between microbes and other larger organisms?
So other organisms, I mean, if we look at vertebrates like ourselves, I mean, they all have their own distinctive microbiome in their guts and on their surface, on the skin surface. And then if we look at insects and other kinds of arthropods, they also have, I mean, each organism has a very, very distinctive microbiome. So in addition to its own genetic identity from the cells that it's actually inherited from or that have developed from the sperm and egg, the original starting point, they've also got these species characteristic microbiome of microorganisms. And we can see these differences even between quite closely related species. So if we look, for example, at humans and other species of ape, a few remaining species of ape, our microbiome is really quite similar to the microbiome of the bonobo, less similar to the chimpanzee, less similar to gorillas and orangutans. And that's quite interesting because bonobos have largely a fruit-based diet. And so despite differences in our dietary preferences and the fact that our diet obviously is very refined, that there are these very basic similarities in the composition of the microorganisms that exist in our guts.
Would you speak also about the symbiosis with plants?
Yes, so if we look at a plant, also we're looking at a teeming ecosystem rather than an individual. A plant cannot survive without mutualistic organisms, microorganisms that interact with its roots, for example. So there's a whole collection of different mycorrhizal fungi that shuttle nutrients from the soil, nutrients and soil, from a vast volume of soil and supply the plant with some of its dietary needs in terms of minerals, but also water supply. And in return for that service, the fungus actually receives some sugars from the plant. So this is what we call a mutualistic symbiosis. It's a mutually supportive relationship. But there are also clouds, a galaxy of bacteria that exist around the root surface, controlling, as I said earlier, controlling soil fertility, but also supplying the root system with essential nutrients. The plant's surface is also covered with microorganisms, and there are also microorganisms that live inside the plant. And the role of these in supporting plant growth is poorly understood in most cases, but you can split open a plant and find all kinds of different microorganisms in the plant, particularly rich in fungi that grow with it inside plant tissues.
What efforts are taking place to conserve biodiversity and microbes?
Actually, very little directly. I think still we have such a poor understanding of the scale, the scope of microbial biodiversity, that it would be difficult to come up with a sensible conservation strategy at this point to conserve particular microorganisms. But certainly by conserving habitats, this is going to have the immediate effect of also conserving the microbes and sustaining the microbial diversity in that particular location. So there's actually very, very few examples of microorganisms that are placed on endangered species lists. There are actually a few examples in Europe of particular mushroom-forming fungi that show up on these red data lists of threatened or endangered species.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
The most important thing would just be to get people interested in actually looking at biology using a microscope. I think just that there's so much to be learned and so much joy to be found in actually just looking at a drop of pond water and just observing the teeming range of diversity of organisms that you can find in these quotidian locations. In the book, I talk about looking at the water in the pond in my backyard in Ohio, which seems like an unpromising place, but based on a very broad reading of biology, all of the major forms of life are actually found in that little pond in my backyard in Ohio. I think it would be very, very important to make sure that children of all ages actually in their classrooms at school get to actually look at samples of, well, pond water, look at soil, look at plants, again, with a microscope, but also looking at human tissues, too. I mean, I recognize that there are some health concerns there, but this should be a revelatory experience for a child to actually see her or his own cheek cells, for example. This may be something that most of your listeners did in school years ago, that actually doing a scrape from your cheek and looking at the cells under the microscope. The kids should be bouncing off the walls when they see this. I mean, look, these little morsels of life, this is what I'm made from. And that structure in the center of the cell, the nucleus, that's where my 23 pairs of chromosomes are housed. I think that would be wonderful if this actually stimulated teachers to push their students, to introduce their students to the microbial world.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
That there is so much to be learned about biology that I think we live in an age when it's tempting to consider that the big questions have been answered. But because there's been so little attention, historically at least, paid to the microbial world, there's so much more work to be done. There is so much joy to be found in the exploration of nature using a microscope.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Nick.
Thank you so much.
You are just listening to Nick Money, professor of botany at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, and author of the book, The Amoeba in the Room, Lives of the Microbes, published in 2014 by Oxford University Press. For more information, check on the web at nickmoney.com. Again, that's nickmoney.com. You are invited to join Nick Money at Town Hall Seattle for his talk, The Microbes Around Us, on Wednesday, May 21st at 7:30 p.m. Again, Town Hall Seattle, May 21st at 7:30 p.m. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on Listener Powered 90.3 FM and kexp.org.